Okay, the exams are coming. They're upstairs. I came running here, and the TA went back to get them. Couple of things. I put up the homework 3 online. It'll be due next Thursday. All 5 problems, I just put them up once. And so since you anyway have a holiday on Tuesday, so you can spend it doing the homework. The project part C is also up. Okay? Actually, let me just show you things that we have here. So here are the homework 3 questions. It's basically page rank stuff, which we have done a bunch of time back, but you also did a project 2, so you remember all that stuff. But there's a question on that, and then question on clustering, question on text classification, and collaborative filtering. Those are the questions we have on that. And the project, the last project is up, okay? And it's basically you can do some clustering tasks. Definitely task 6 and task 7 are both basically clustering. And then there are a bunch of extra credit tasks that you can do. In fact, I might change this a bit and say that instead of task 7, you can pick one of the lower ones as an alternative, because task 6 and 7 are both clustering. Okay, but I'll do that, you know, soon enough. But you know at least what's up with the project, and you would be you will have to give this back on 12/4, which is the 4th of December, and the last class is 12/9, December 9th. Okay, and between 4th and 9th, there would be a demo where you would do a demo. I mean, you'll have to sign up and show the entire system working to the TA. Okay, so he'll give you the timings for that. But basically, by 4th, you have to have everything working, the report, everything due. And then, you know, after that is the demo. Okay. Then, what else? One more thing I was going to say. As far as the rest of the semester is concerned, I put up the classes coming up, since we are in the final stretch almost. So today we'll be doing the recommender systems, and then next class there is no class. Then we will do basically shift into the third big topic for the semester, which is basically structured data on the web. Okay, how do you deal with databases? How do you deal with semi-structured data? The idea of semantic web. Extracting data from the web such that you can provide structure to it, and then integrating such extracted or annotated data. So those are the things that we will do in the rest of the time. Thank you. And then, so 12/16 is the final exam for the class. According to the university schedule, so you have the entire schedule in front of you. Okay, and then there'll be one homework that's coming up beyond homework 3. That's homework 4, and that would essentially cover all these topics. Okay, and I will try to make sure that the homework problems are up as soon as the topic is covered, and you would be better off doing them right away too, because they won't be any big buffer after this. Okay. Are there any questions? None. Okay. I'll give you the yes.
The final exam is just in this room, right?
I guess so, yeah. It would be in the same room as far as I'm concerned. As far as it does.
Okay.
Yes, that will be the case. Any other questions? Okay, and you are obviously in the wrong country. If you were in Kenya, both yesterday and today would have been holidays for you because of the presidential election here. I don't know why we don't get any holidays. That's a different story. Okay, so we are in the middle of discussing personalization and recommender systems. I gave you an overview last class, and what I'm going to do now is quickly go through some of the overview slides that I mentioned anyway last time, and then go into describing the application of naive-based classification for content-based filtering, and describe the details of collaborative filtering, and then, you know, time permitting, talk about also talk about combining both of them to make up for each other's faults or limitations, and then time permitting, we might actually review the idea that I mentioned last class, which was essentially you could use unlabeled examples to improve performance of a classifier system. Okay. In fact, that is kind of related to the way you would wind up using content-based and collaborative filtering ideas together too. Okay, so that's the idea. This, you know, recommender systems are useful, and you're trying to sell more things, you're trying to give more things to people that they might be, you know, interested in. In traditional, one interesting thing, of course, is that you could actually have recommendations just based on content, which is the only thing that you can do if you have a single user, or you can also do recommendation based on many users, and so if many users have similar, if you have multiple users, then you can talk about other users who have similar tastes as you, and then use that to give you the recommendations. Okay. Again, I mentioned this last time. If I'm going, if there is anything here in the first few slides that you want me to go slower on, stop me. Okay. If not, we basically mentioned much of this last time. So you can recommend things, you know, in any kind of selling situation, or to also give you suggestions as to what else you might be interested in. And then in the online stores, recommendation systems have actually been shown to improve the sales. So that's why there's a lot of interest. You know, how many of you know the Netflix prize? Okay, have you won it? What's the point? Right? So Netflix prize basically is exactly about this. Netflix, how many of you know what Netflix is? Okay, good. See? Okay, so at least I'm finally, since you cannot go back in time, I'm coming forward in time so that we'll have some kind of shared vocabulary. Netflix is obviously, I don't know much about Netflix. I don't own, you know, I'm not a member. But so you can get these movies by mail, right? And then one of the interesting things is if you have liked a couple of movies, then what might be other movies that you might potentially like? Okay, so Netflix is interested exactly in giving you better recommendations. Okay, and if to the extent they can give you more recommendations, you are likely to rent more movies, and so you'll be happy and they'll be happy because they're getting rent from you. Okay, now they are interested in doing it in any which way. They're interested in doing it based on the past movies that you have rented and just do content-based filtering on that. And they're also interested in past movies you have rented and other people who have rented similar movies, and then trying to use that to tell you what, you know, movies you might be interested in. Okay, so what Netflix basically was saying, I think last year, right? Last year or just before that, they essentially realized that they have gone quite far, but not far enough in actually being able to give very good recommendations. And so they put up, I think, $1 million prize where they provided the data and they kept the test data with themselves, and you are supposed to provide recommendations based on the training data. And if you can reach very high levels of accuracy, where I think they have set up certain thresholds, then whoever reaches a certain level of accuracy will get $1 million. This is actually a cheap way of getting employees, you know, instead of actually hiring people. You just, you know, give people, you know, $1 million and everybody will start working with that. But anyway, that's one of the things that is relevant because Amazon, Netflix, all these things are very interested in recommending you items based on your previous interest. Now, in recommendation systems, one big thing, of course, which we will assume for the rest of the class is that somehow I know what your interests are and I know what other users' interests are. Okay? Now, how did I figure that out? I, the system, how did I figure out what your interests are? I need to kind of get some way of, I have to get feedback from the user as to what are the items that they're interested in. Okay? There are, of course, the obvious way, which is the intrusive way, where you provide these things and say, you know, give us a rating. Okay? Or whenever you rent a movie, then you can actually give a rating to the movie after you return it. Okay? The other idea would be to basically, the problem with that is most people don't take time to actually give the ratings. Okay? And so the other idea would be to do this indirectly. By, you know, basically without asking people directly. So depending on the way you click pages and you stare at some pages more often than longer times than others, if you print and save certain click pages, and also if you bought items from, you know, Amazon kind of places where you actually buy a book, that's basically you're putting your money, so you must have liked it. Okay, of course, if you returned it later, then they should remove that from your consideration, but, you know, they may or may not do that. Okay, but this business of feedback detection is an important thing. In some cases, such as Amazon, it's sort of reasonably obvious because if you bought the book, probably you definitely liked it. But even Amazon, for example, says that it keeps track of just the pages that you have seen, include, you know, not just the ones that you have bought, but you know, the items that you have seen in the last couple of sessions, and then tries to tell you that people who are looking at this are also looking at these things. Okay? Again, it's basically non-intrusive ways of giving, getting your feedback. Okay? Obviously, buying is a much higher rating than just looking, but not looking is much lower rating, right? I mean, because that means you don't even know them. Okay. One other thing, so this is the beginning. How, you know, here is the recommender system, it needs the ratings. How do you get the ratings? That was this slide. Okay? Now once the recommender system recommends, most people would like to know why are you recommending it to me? What's the reason you are recommending it to me? Okay? Now justifications are important. Now justifications may not actually make much sense, but the very fact that the system tried to justify is helpful. Okay, the question is, if you just say, see this movie to your friend, they may or may not take you seriously. If you then make up a fake explanation saying, see this movie because, and then you say some reason, then they use that reason to decide whether or not to take your recommendation seriously. Now in the case of systems, of course, you know, Amazon, for example, when they recommend, they'll say, why did we recommend it? And there is a link, and if you click on it, they'll try to give you the justification. In fact, one of the interesting things is the very fact that they have that link there, you know, from a human-computer interaction point of view, makes people happy. That, in fact, it's not just making recommendations. It has a reason, okay? Well, I don't need to know what your reason is most of the time. But if you do click on that particular link, oftentimes they will try to say that you have bought the following books, and so we think you would be interested in this book. Okay, now that's a very primitive type of recommendation. Okay, but it's better than nothing. Okay, so the question is, how do you get those kinds of recommendations, justifications? How do you get high quality justifications for your recommendations is an important issue. Okay, we will assume that, you know, that always comes after the recommender system. And in fact, whether or not people will take the recommendation depends on how good the justification is. Right? Now, in terms of content-based versus collaborative filtering systems, content-based systems are much easier they have a much easier job in justifying their recommendations because they can actually give some sort of a recommendation, justification based on the other keywords, the features of the items that you have bought. Okay? But collaborative systems have a harder time justifying, because essentially all you can say is people like you seem to like this. That's for everything. The entire collaborative system justification is people like you seem to like these things, so just buy it. I mean, and if you do it for everything, then it's not a particularly useful explanation. So there is that interesting question as to how do you justify the recommendations for collaborative systems, collaborative recommenders. Okay, but again, this is one end. That's the previous one is the, how do the ratings come, and this one is how do you justify the ratings to the user if they want justification. But the rest of the class will sit in the middle, okay, and talk about how to take the ratings, give recommendations, okay. And you can do it in two ways. One is content-based, and another is collaborative filtering. Okay, content-based filtering essentially the set of items that you have rated are basically described in terms of some features in a feature space, and then the ratings are the labels for these items, liked, not liked, or +10, -10, you know, 0, etc. And then you are essentially doing a classification learning. You're trying to learn the concept behind these ratings. Okay. So you can do any amount of, you know, any of the classification learning techniques there. So naive-based classification that we talked about is an example that we'll look at here. Okay. The one thing that this thing requires is a description of items in terms of some features. And so, in fact, when you describe the items in terms of features, the features are good, the classification is good. If it's bad, the classification can be quite bad. Okay. So that's all that stuff that we discussed in the last couple of classes still remains. In the case of collaborative filtering, in essence, you are assuming that users are really just vectors in the space of items. So each user basically can be described in terms of their likes and dislikes over the set of items that you're trying to sell them. And then you can compare users by comparing the user vectors, okay, item vectors of the user, okay? And then basically try to find, you know, the one idea in using this information, as I mentioned last time, and we'll get into details in a minute again, is to find the closest K users for the current user. And then say whatever else that they like that you haven't yet bought can be recommended to you. That's one way of doing it. Okay. One advantage here, of course, is needs ratings only from other users. It doesn't need to know what is the thing that's being rated. Okay. Here, on the other hand, you need to know what the thing is, because you're sort of describing that thing in terms of meaningful features. Okay, here, you know, one item, as I mentioned last time, some items can be books, some can be CDs, some can be, you know, vacation packages, it doesn't matter. Okay, and then of course there are disadvantages. So here you can think of requiring features as a disadvantage, and the fact that you can't cross over domains as a disadvantage too. Here you can think of the fact that in the beginning, if you don't have too many other users or users who are close enough to you, you won't get any recommendations. Okay? That's the basic trade-offs between these two ideas. Okay. So we'll talk about content-based first because that's essentially, you know, using a classification system. And we'll just say we'll use naive-based classification again. Okay? So there are lots of systems, and any classification learner can be used, but, you know, one idea is to just use, you know, naive-based classifier that we talked about earlier. The one difference would be, one minor extension you can do is that if you have, let's say, a book, so previously we've been talking about text classification systems, and we used naive-based classifier as a text classification system. Now, if you have something like a book, a record of a book on Amazon, it's text. I mean, you can take the entire, information, metadata about the book, and write it as a single document, and think of it as a single bag of words. But really, there is structure to it, because, you know, what they would probably do is they will say title, author, and publisher, price, review, etc. Okay, so there is basically
and there is a bunch of text here. In all these places, there is a bunch of text. So rather than just combining everything into one single text bag, you can think of them as a bag of bags. Okay? So each field will become its own text bag. And then a word appearing in one field might have a different impact on the class description of the example than it appearing in a different field. Right? A word or a string. Okay? So all you would need to do essentially is still do the naive-based classification, except now we will be, you know, computing with, we have this bag of fields, and the bag of bags where each field corresponds to a separate bag of words. Okay? And then we want to keep each bag different, and we have now vector of m bags where m is the number of fields. And then within each bag, you are computing the word probability for that bag given the class. Okay? So rather than to compute the probability that given a book, it belongs to a particular class, the classes that we are interested in Amazon kind of scenarios is the user would be interested or not interested. Those are the two classes. Right? So if you are considering this, right, this is the computing the class given the book description. However, the book really is M fields, and each field is a bag of words. Okay? So what you would be computing is essentially the probability that a word appears in, given that, you know, in a document that belongs to class CJ, that word appears in the field M. Okay? Normally, in the naive-based classification for just pure text, we only had that information. Now you wind up getting multiple numbers, one corresponding to the same word appearing in different different bags, different fields. There was a question. Well, no, you can basically, it's not, you know, in fact, if there is a bunch of excerpt of the book, that would be content. That would be one more field.
Does the number of bags?
What? Again, one of the interesting things is if you are into naive-based classification, if a particular book does not have excerpt, another book has an excerpt. A particular book doesn't have review, another one has a review, you can still use whatever description you have. Because in essence, naive-based classifier, as we discussed last time, essentially it can be used to compute the current best probability estimate given the partial description you have. Okay? We would have to hope that in the training data, you know, it would be good if you had all the fields that are important are put in the training data. If none of the training data contained the field that you are that's important, then you would never use it during the testing, right? Okay. One other thing, actually, in terms of this sort of an idea, is that you can also keep track of the profile of a user. So, in fact, when you have a naive-based classification-based recommender system, all you need to remember about a user is basically these numbers. This is what the user is, really, as far as the recommender system is concerned. Okay? These conditional probabilities. And so what I can do, essentially, is basically keep track of these numbers. And one useful way to think about it is also, is that you can actually think of a profile of a user as the set of words that are most indicative of their likes and dislikes. Okay, set of words that are most indicative of their likes and dislikes. And so I'm using a slightly different formalism here, but in essence, these are all probability that a word exists given that the document is of a particular class. Okay? So in particular, since we are talking about whether or not the document or a book is relevant to the user, so you can, having computed all these probabilities from the training data, you can consider the ratio for each word of the probability of that word given that it's a relevant document, and probability of that word given that it's an irrelevant document. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, something like the word the, what would this would be? This ratio, what would it be for the word the? Because it's present in both the relevant and the irrelevant documents. Okay? So this ratio would be 1, and log of 1 would be 0. Whereas, if this word is only present in the relevant ones and very rarely present in the irrelevant ones, then it's a much more much stronger word. Okay, so it's essentially the word odds, and you can just keep track of these logarithmic, these logs of, you know, just a top few words which have this highest odds ratio. And that's a nice way of thinking of, you know, if I have to give a couple of keywords to describe this particular user's profile, these keywords are the ones which have the highest value with respect, highest these odds ratios with respect to relevant versus irrelevant. Okay, but in general, ultimately, this is the more general idea, is that really the user is represented in terms of these conditional probabilities. Okay. Question. It's the same NBC, and this stuff actually we could have talked about it in earlier places too. Essentially, here you can just say, since you're keeping track of the user, then you might be interested in using a profile, you know, giving a profile for the user. And the other thing is that you can talk about naive-based classification when you have semi-structured fields, where there are a bunch of fields, but the values of the fields themselves are text. Again, okay? And, you know, you can, if you don't like this, you can always combine the whole thing into one single document and do naive-based classification on that. The assumption would be that where there is structure, you should try to use it. Because if you don't, normally your classification is not likely to be as accurate. Okay? In fact, for the rest of the semester, we'll be talking about how how when you see a bunch of English text or NLP text, a natural language text, how can you actually split it into different fields? You understand what I'm saying? That's like extracting the structure when, you know, the structure is not directly available. But in something like Amazon, the structure is actually directly available because they said author and gave the information, price and gave the information. And you should think like multiple times before you take the structure and munch it all into, you know, uniform text, because you possibly lost useful information. It might be easier for you to do that. The temptation for doing that, of course, is that way you don't have to learn anything new, right? In the sense, you can just use the same old naive-based classifier. But where there is text, if you know how to exploit it, you can improve your performance. Do you understand what I'm saying? In fact, we will come to something like this a little later too. One of the ideas when you are talking about having databases on the web is, if you have multiple databases, each of them have structured records on the web, right? What's the best way to support querying of these databases? Suppose I have a database, you know, it has a big schema of 120 fields, okay, and the values for each of them. So for each record contains 120 fields, some of them null, some of them have actual values, okay? Those of you who have thought of databases before, you know that if you have this structure, you can actually do selection queries, projection queries, join queries, all this fun stuff. But then you might also say, I'm an information retrieval guy, I don't want to learn databases. Okay? So what I can then do is take this whole, you know, record, write it out as a text file. You understand what I'm saying? So get rid of the content. Get rid of the structure. Why? Because, you know, for the guy with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? We know how to deal with text files. So if you can convert everything into text files, then you can keyword search on the text files. You can't do particularly useful querying, but you can do, you know, the kinds of querying that you can do on IR files. And we'll see that, in fact, you know, this sort of a loser idea, you would think it's a loser idea because somebody gave you content with structure and you went ahead and got rid of the content, got rid of the structure, because it will make your life simple. Okay, this loser idea, if you do it in a large enough scale, you can think of giving it a nicer name, and it's called surfacing the deep web. We'll talk about it later again. Surfacing the deep web, and the way Google actually does it, the way Google supports querying of many databases. There, a couple of years back, there was this big deal about how many government databases are now available for search with Google. What did they do? They took these huge records, converted them into HTML files, threw them to the same crawl and the same indexer, because we have a really big hammer, right? And so, and you know, you can search on them. You can't join, you can't do projection, selections, all that stuff, but most bozos don't want that anyway. And so we can get by with this, and we can give it a good name called surfacing of the deep web, and write papers on that. Okay, but it's an interesting point. You know, at least you should have one idea as to how to do it, and this is one idea. And we came to that because if you got rid of the field structure, then you would have been doing something like that. You can get rid of the field structure and do normal naive-based classification, and that way you would lose. You don't have to write a new example, new learning algorithm, but it's going to be likely to be less effective. Okay. For the collaborative filtering, again, as I mentioned last time already, what you're trying to find is, given a new user and a bunch of existing users, you're trying to find the guys who are closest to this user from the list of users, okay? And then based on them, extract recommendations for this guy based on his or her closest user, closest neighbor. Okay. Now the idea, of course, is anything that this guy has bought here, C has been rated here. This guy doesn't have a rating for C, so you can now go ahead and say you are likely to give a rating of 8 to C. And to the extent higher rating means more relevant, I can start showing you the item C. That's the basic idea. Okay. The big question, of course, is, given a user is basically a ratings matrix on the world of items. Okay, just as documents are words and their frequencies, now in collaborative filtering, users are vectors in the space of items, and the dimension, the value of each item is the rating for that item. Now, as soon as I said this, you should remember all the other stuff we talked about before. For example, what do you mean vectors? Are these items really completely independent of each other? Maybe not. Maybe, in fact, there are, you know, somebody, it's like my son just recently bought a V, and it turns out that if you buy a V, then you have to buy a huge number of other things, like a nunchuck and something else, and apparently even a huge big TV, which I didn't know before I agreed to buy this little V, right? Most of you probably could have seen it coming from a mile away, that, you know, my son was trying to put one over me, and, you know, this is the way he's going to get a huge big TV. But I was thinking these are all completely independent items, right? I mean, and that's basically more or less what you would do if you are thinking of this vector as made up of independent dimensions. So you can do LSI, and you can get dependencies between them. So even as I'm speaking, think of all the ways you can, you know, take the stuff that you have learned before and put it on top of this. But I'll tell you the simpler ways, you know, of just given the two vectors, you know, how to define the distance between them. Okay. In the case of document vectors on the space of words and their frequencies, cosine theta metric was a reasonable idea. You can still do that here too. Okay. But there is a better distance metric that seems to make more sense, and that's the Pearson correlation coefficient. Okay. Just as when we were talking about documents and the distances between documents, we did consider other distance metrics. We considered Euclidean distance, we considered Jaccard similarity, and we talked about why they are good or bad with respect to the cosine theta similarity that we went with finally. Okay, what we will do for these is Pearson correlation coefficient. And so again, in a collaborative filtering scenario, what you have is an item user matrix, where user is a document in the space of items. And so as I said, you can do scalar clustering, you can do just simple vector similarity between the users. That would be one way of defining distance. It's not necessarily the worst possible way. It's just that it probably, again, the definition of distance in a space does tend to give domain-specific semantics, because since you do not necessarily have any idea as to whether or not the features that you picked are independent or not, and whether or not they are exhaustive, when you provide a specific way of defining distance between two vectors, you are giving some domain-independent, domain-specific information. Okay. Anyway, so you could do vector similarity, you can do scalar clusters, you can do latent semantic indexing. Latent semantic indexing and scalar clusters can still be done. The one question that I still want to ask is, what distance would you want to use? Okay. And the distance that you want to use is in terms of covariances and variances of the ratings per user. Okay. So the Pearson correlation coefficient between a user A and a user U is defined in terms of the covariance of their ratings divided by the variance of their ratings. Okay, product of the variance of the rating. Now, covariance is essentially defined this way. So you compute the mean rating for each of the users and consider for each item how much it differs from the mean value. And then, so for the ith item, A's rating on ith item differs from its mean by this much. And at the same time, U's rating for that same item differs this way. Okay? And then you multiply them. Okay? That's basically the way of computing a covariance. Okay? For overall the items. And then you divide it by the number of items. Okay? And the variance is done basically, variance is covariance with respect to yourself. Okay? And so you would wind up computing the distance and square it. Okay? Actually, in fact, you, in this case, you're taking the square root, so this is standard deviation rather than the variance. Okay? And so you have a covariance divided by the standard deviation of the first user and the standard deviation of the second user multiplied. Okay? Now, the advantage of this is that if you take the same user, so if you compute the Pearson correlation coefficient for the same user, UU, then this would be sigma square by sigma times sigma. It'll be 1. So the user is more similar to itself. If you are not, then you're in trouble already. Okay, and so that would be, that's at least reasonable in terms of the similarity. Okay, and anything else will be lower. Okay, so you use this as the distance now. This has the same sort of an idea as the vector similarity in the sense it's between 0 and 1, but who gets zeros, who gets ones, and who gets what middle values is changing here in terms of, you know, this idea of defining variances and standard deviation. Okay? Now the question then is, given this, you have a distance measure, so you now have to pick a bunch of neighbors for a given user. Okay? So you can obviously pick k nearest neighbors. Compute the distance with respect to every user and pick the k nearest neighbor. Okay? Now of course, having picked k nearest neighbors, you can say all of them are equally important, or you can rate them in terms of their distance from you. Do you understand what I'm saying? So one idea is basically to just assume, so the question of course is to provide a weight for each of the users, okay? And the weight could just be the distance, okay? And we'll, in the beginning we'll assume that, okay? In the beginning we'll assume that the weight will be just the distance, okay? So now the issue is that given for a new user, you're trying to compute their rating for the ith item. To do that, you start with the mean rating of this user, this new user, and then add to it a delta, which is given by essentially what all the other people who rated this item are rating it as, in terms of how far are they from their mean values. Okay, so how far are they, each of the neighbors from their mean values for that particular item? Multiply that by the weight, which is the distance, how close this guy is to you. Add them up, divided by the weight, sum of weights. Because these weights don't have to add up to one. These are just a bunch of distances to k neighbors. And there's no reason why they have to add up to one. So when you're weighting these, then you have to divide by the sum of weights. Okay, that'll give you a delta that you're adding to RA to get you essentially the rating for the ith item that A should have, according to this analysis. That's what is collaborative filtering. That's the simplest idea of collaborative filtering. Okay. On top of this, you can do things like latent semantic indexing. You can do, definitely you can do latent semantic indexing, for example, if you're interested. One issue, of course, is that things can start looking extreme. So here is my favorite example. Actually, I'm giving away an exam question that I had used in the past, but, it's a worthwhile exam question to talk about. So suppose there's this one guy who basically lived with his wife 40 years, and they have had seen bunches of movies, okay? Now, husbands and wives don't necessarily have to like movies together. I mean, in fact, the longer the marriage, probably they didn't get onto each other's nerves, they probably watched different movies, okay? But anyway, so you have computed the closeness of this husband's distance to the wife's distance, wife vector, in terms of their interest in the movies, right? And then this guy started also having an affair. I mean, I don't know why I'm talking about this here, but separately. Okay, now when you are having affair, you probably, again, I'm giving you all sorts of useful information, you at least want to act as if for those 3.5 days that you actually have exactly the same interest as the other person. So the chance that, so this other person that this guy was having an affair with, they're more likely to say, oh, you like this movie, I like this movie too. Oh, you like this other movie, I like that movie too, right? So they have seen 3 movies together. According to that, their distance would be, the similarity would be 1. Do you understand what I'm saying? So now a new movie has come, okay? And the wife says, based on what I know, I don't think you would be interested in seeing this. This other person says, based on the other person's interest, you think you should see it because they are much closer, you are much closer to the other person's interest based on the collaborative filtering. Now clearly even you can see that what is happening here is the amount of movies that you have seen together in deciding that you are soulmates is too small, right? Okay, how do you deal with that? You can deal with it by, so the point is that this whole thing is a setup to say that this entire calculation is made only for the items that both users have rated together. If one of them didn't rate that item, then you can't use it in the calculation. What that means is if two users, in a space of million items, if two users have only rated one common item, and they more or less rated it to be high, then suddenly this coefficient will be 1. So you somehow have to take into account not just the correlation, but also how big is the data on which the correlation is computed. Okay, the usual cheap way to do this is essentially say that you define the weight to be some scale factor times the weight, scale factor times the Pearson correlation coefficient, where the scale factor would be changed with respect to the number of examples, number of common items that you have both rated. Okay, and then so a simplistic idea would be to say one if you have done more than 50 items together. Otherwise, it would be linearly changing up to 50. So from 1 to 50 commonly rated items, you'd be going like that, and then after 50, you become 1. You can consider any other function you want to do. The more important thing is to realize that the correlation is by itself not enough, because you have to consider how many items you have co-rated together. Okay? That's an interesting point. So you do that too, and then you will actually take that into account in actually doing these collaborative filtering predictions, and that normally helps. Okay. So what are the problems with collaborative filtering? Cold start, you have to have enough users before you can find users who are close enough to you. Sparsity, if there are too many items to be recommended, even if there are many users, the user rating matrix would be sparse. So there won't be enough people who have, there won't be enough core ratings between any pair of users. Okay. Then there's of course the first rater problem. That means the guy who is trying to rate, the guy who is buying the first the item in the beginning, they won't have any ratings to begin with. Okay. So things like new items and esoteric items. This is again the same idea we're talking about. Like CNN, for example, or New York Times, they say most emailed articles are the most popular articles. And popularity breeds popularity. Everybody just starts clicking on those most popular items because they are popular already. Okay. But how did the guys who are not popular become popular? No. You have to assume that there are some jobless people who actually not look, who have a different goal in life, and rather than just reading the top 10 popular articles, they're actually reading the entire New York Times, believe it or not, and then picking some of them and sending it to their friends. Or maybe New York Times editors are putting some of them into these popular things. The moment you put them in the top 10, they will increase because more and more people are likely to pick. Okay, so there is this issue as to how do you, I, you know, suggest to you an item that hasn't yet been rated by anybody else. Okay, now in this particular case, does content-based filtering have this problem? No, because you know Amazon still can tell me that here is a book you would be interested in because you have been buying all the books by the following author, and this also is by that particular author. And you're buying all the books which have the following keywords. This book also has these keywords. So content-based filtering doesn't have this problem. Okay. And then of course there's this popularity bias in the sense that if you have a user with too many, you know, kind of a unique taste who don't fall in the popular, who are not average taste, then they would not have enough, close enough neighbors. And so the recommendations that they get would be particularly useless. Okay, one of the interesting things is the k nearest neighbors, you know, you may just say that just take the k closest nearest neighbor, okay? Maybe the closest neighbor is very far from you because you have very, you know, esoteric taste. Okay, so collaborative filtering tends to recommend popular items that may be of interest to you. But if you are never interested in popular items, if your whole description is that you don't like popular items, then you're dead. And also it's important from the seller's point of view too, because how does something become popular? Before other people buy it, you know, you still need to recommend it to people so that enough people would buy it. And some of them are actually offset by the problems of content-based approach. For example, they don't need any data on other users. You can recommend it to users with unique tastes because the only thing you are using is the user's own relevance judgments. Okay, and so there is no first rater problem, and then you can also provide explanations on recommended items using the keywords and how the keywords of the items that you have bought in the past are related to the keywords of the item that I'm about to recommend to you. Whereas collaborative filtering, all it can say is other people are interested. Okay, now of course, you know, both of them are sort of learning problems, but you know, in the case of content-based filtering, it's really direct classification learning problem. Okay. Now the disadvantages for this is it requires the content be put in some meaningful features. And furthermore, these features are likely to be similar for books, but the features for books might be different from the features for CDs. Features for CDs might be different from the features for electronic items. And they might be different from the features for Hawaii vacation. Okay, and if you want to kind of mix them all up and start do association rule learning, remember the, you know, some of you who have heard of association rule learning, the classic example of it, apparently, I don't know why this makes sense, but apparently people who bought diapers also would buy beer. I don't know why the heck, you know, what these guys are doing, I have no clue, you know, but apparently this entire field of association rule mining is based on this insight that people who bought diapers are also buying beer. So then Safeways of the world will essentially put huge big beer kegs right next to diapers. Okay, I mean, I'm not even trying to go and explain to myself why this happens, but the point is, that's a classic case where you're going across item classes. You know, diapers and beer have really nothing in common, other than the fact that the same guy is speaking up. Okay, collaborative filtering can do this, in essence. Okay, people who are buying, you know, who are listening to Rush Limbaugh are buying this book. You listen to Rush Limbaugh, so you are likely to be buying this book. Okay, that's what collaborative filtering can do for you. Content-based filtering cannot do that, because it needs separate feature spaces for each of them. Okay, and of course, you know, you don't have any ability to exploit the other user's judgment and build up on that. So having set this up, I can say combine them. Combine content-based and collaborative filtering. Why must you have them in two different spaces? And there are many ways of combining them. You can try to think about it. You know, one idea is page rank and similarity. Right? We could have had this entire discussion again talking about both of them, and then we had to say combine them. And then we actually talked about two ways of combining them. One is alpha times apples plus 1 minus alpha times oranges. That's page rank plus similarity. The other is take the most similar items and compute their overall similarity by building the base set and figuring out the authority subs, or even page rank within that. Those are two ways of combining them. So the question is, if I have content-based and collaborative filtering technologies both available to me, how can I combine them? Okay, I'll give you one idea. You can think of other ideas. Okay. One idea would be that most of the time, the reason collaborative filtering doesn't seem to work is the sparsity of the ratings matrix. Because most people have rated very few items in their life. And so the likelihood that there would be enough ratings commonalities between two different vectors is low. That means most of the time, essentially, you don't have enough similar neighbors to begin with. So here is the idea. So I have a user ratings vector. These are the only pieces for which I actually have ratings, some actual numbers. The rest is all null values. What I really would like to do is guess what these numbers are. Now I can, you know, pain the user saying, you know, please rate, whether you buy it or not, please rate every book in our catalog. Otherwise, we won't want to talk to you. And they'll say, fine, that's not good. So what you would do instead is take the user ratings vector and do a content-based predictor just based on the user ratings and feed it back into the vector. So I will try to understand why you rated these to be good, or why you rated these to have these ratings. This is my classifier system, which basically fit, you know, this is a function which I think is underlying these ratings. Now if I'm right, then I should be able to figure out for you what you would, you know, how much you would like these remaining items, based on what you like in your own case. So then these are pseudo ratings. These are pseudo ratings. These are, no, the user didn't rate correctly, but essentially to the extent this is a good generalization, you know, it should have actually worked. Now I can just stop here at this point itself. Okay, and say, you know, if you are just doing content-based filtering, these would be the ratings that I would have given you for this particular item. Okay, I can do a little better by now bringing in the collaborative filtering. I can say now every user vector is filled up. Some with real ratings, some with pseudo ratings. Now just do the collaborative filtering idea as we discussed previously. Do you understand what I'm saying? To some extent, what this does is, in essence, it, you know, captures two vectors which probably should have been more similar, but they are not seen to be similar, because an item, if I looked at it at all, I would have gained it a high rating, but I didn't look at it yet. So because of that, the two vectors would be seen to be dissimilar. Okay, so let's go back to my V example, right? You know, if I'm buying a V, I'm going to buy an extra nunchuck. Apparently, I don't know, do any of you know this stuff? I have figured this all out in the last 1 week. So you have to buy an extra nunchuck, right? And so I haven't yet bought, as of last week, when I just got my V, I haven't yet bought this extra nunchuck. But all of you know that I'm going to buy it anyway, right? based on just the content-based filtering. Now, by just putting that pseudo rating there, you would then be able to compare me better to somebody who has both a V and an uncheck. Because everybody who has a V also has an uncheck. I am the only guy for the next 1 week, I still didn't have it. This content-based filtering is making sure that my similarity with them is correctly established. The moment I do that, then I will realize that people with V and uncheck, etc., are also likely to buy the following items. And so the collaborative filtering can then come into play. Okay? So now you have the user rate matrix, you have a content-based predictor, you have a pseudo-ratings matrix, and you do collaborative filtering on the pseudo-ratings matrix. And there is, in fact, a link, I give you a paper link, basically, who did careful study on this simple idea and show that, you know, it does actually better than just collaborative filtering or just content-based filtering. Okay? A nice idea. Okay? So that's basically the recommendation systems of two types and combining them together. Okay? Now what I will do in the next 15 minutes is to actually sort of come out of recommendation systems and go back into text classification, a classification in general, because it gives me a good reason to do so, having thought about this. So the question is, first of all, where else did you think of this type of providing pseudo ratings? What? Page rank. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's just an iterative algorithm. Here you are just making up numbers based on the other numbers. And you know, one place where you may or may not remember this, there is this idea called pseudo relevance feedback that we discussed in the class. Okay? And what is pseudo relevance feedback? Does anybody remember what pseudo relevance feedback? Exactly. That's what it was. So normal relevance feedback says, I will show you the top 10 results. You, the user, tell me which are relevant, which are irrelevant. Then I will do your Rocky Hill classification. Right? Pseudo relevance feedback says, users are a headache. Let's get rid of them. Okay? So I'll act as if I'm smart enough. So it's my smartness which gave me the top 10 results. Okay, I'll assume those top 10 are really relevant because I said so. And then do relevance feedback based on that. And what's interesting is people have shown that pseudo-relevance feedback works better than just top 10 results in some cases. So that's the kind of idea that we have done here. Okay, that's the word pseudo. That's the last time you heard the word pseudo in this class, pseudo-relevance feedback. Okay, if you can do this for ratings, why can't I do this for simple classification? And that's the idea that I was mentioning last class. So basically, if I have been given a bunch of training examples which are labeled, okay, so here is the idea. What this guy, content-based filter, had is a bunch of training examples. Some of them are labeled. For these, you know the ratings. Based on the labeled ones, it learned a predictor. And that's used to predict what these unlabeled examples are likely to get their labels as. And at this point, what I did was I went with this to the collaborative filtering, which is a different kind of a learning algorithm. Okay? However, why could I have not stopped right here and fed it back to the content-based filter? See, previously it only had these as the training examples. You know that learning approaches can improve their accuracy if they see more and more training examples. Okay? So what you had essentially is, unlike your friend who only had 15 labeled training examples and nothing more, you had 15 labeled training examples and 2,000 unlabeled training examples. Having unlabeled training examples is better than not having them. The question is, how can you use them? I just told you. Which is, you could use content-based predictor to actually provide the labels for these unlabeled examples. And now this becomes a bigger training data. Rerun it That looks like a nice, beautiful way of making something out of nothing, right? It turns out that it actually works. As long as, so the idea that I have is learn an I-based classifier C0 using just a few items for which we have the user ratings. Okay? And then use the C0 to predict the ratings for the rest of the unlabeled examples. So in this particular case, unrated items. Okay? And then get into this loop where you learn a new classifier CI using all the ratings, real and predicted, from the I minus 1th iteration. Okay? And continue, re-predict, until ratings don't change. Okay? This idea almost works. And in fact, first of all, this idea, as I mentioned last time, is very similar to the idea of k-means, where you picked means, recompute, and then decided clusters, recomputed means, redecided clusters, until clusters didn't change. If you think of clusters as different classes, that was the kind of idea you're doing there. Okay. So the question then is, how do you actually make sure that this works? You know, the only change that you need to make is, rather than, you know, just assume that the most likely class is the only class. So the idea would be normal naive-based classifier compute. Suppose you have C1, C2, etc. up to CN. So it's an M class problem. In the simplest scenario, C1, C2. C1 means relevant, C2 means not relevant. C1, C2, CN would be there are ratings 1, rating 2, etc. up to rating 10. Okay? If you have a N class classification problem, what naive-based classifier would do is, given a new example, it computes the probability that this is the class, this is the class, this is the class, given this example. And whichever is the highest probability, it just sticks to it and assumes that that is 1.0 probability, that is the label. Right? So suppose this one came up with this as 0.7, this as 0.002, this as 0.21, and so on. It just takes this. I say, keep this entire vector. And if you kept this entire vector, that would essentially say that this example is 0.7 this label, 0.002 this label, 0.21 this label. That's like essentially exactly like the idea of clustering as basically, remember I talked about, if you have generated the original data as a mixture of Gaussians and you're trying to compute their means and variances, the right way to do it is essentially to re-estimate the means and variances. Okay? And in doing so, I said, for each item, you keep track of the probability that it comes from the first one, comes from the second one. And then that would be the fractional membership of this item in each of the clusters. If you do that, essentially what you're doing in these kinds of scenarios is expectation maximization algorithm. Okay? And it works. Just the same way it worked there. As to why it works and why EM works is a more involved topic I'm not going to be able to discuss here. But, you know, there is enough of this type of ideas that you have looked at, especially at least in this particular case, clustering as well as k-means clustering, whose more general case is essentially computing soft clusters by re-estimating the means and variances of the original Gaussian. Okay? And then, so all you have to do in this for this to work is to keep track of not just the class label, but the posterior probability of the classes. Remember, if those of you are still keeping track of what I'm saying, you should be wondering, but didn't you tell us that NBC is particularly bad at computing the posterior probabilities? And you said that even though these numbers are long, the order could be right. That's why NBC works. I did say that. Okay, but all I'm saying is, if you are going through this loop, you are better off keeping track of the probability vector rather than just the single label. Because in doing the single label, you're going even farther away from the real distribution, and you're saying it's 10000. Okay, and you know, here is a little proof in the pudding. This again is a paper that I have linked from the class page. Which is basically this algorithm, really, this algorithm here is exactly what I've described here. And more interestingly, here is a scenario where I am given, so basically I'm computing the accuracy of a learner. And these are called learning curves. And the way you compute the accuracy of a learning algorithm is as you increase the number of training examples, how is its accuracy on the test data doing? Okay? You assume that any reasonable learning algorithm, okay, as you increase the number of training examples, it could only, its performance should only increase. It shouldn't worsen. Okay, in terms of the accuracy. So in this case, this is your normal naive Bayes classifier, which just has the labeled document. So here it has exactly 20 labeled documents, here 50 labeled, here is 100 labeled, here is 200 labeled, and so on. As increase the number of training examples, its accuracy improves. The top one, on the other hand, is this other guy who, apart from having the number of training examples, also has 10,000 unlabeled documents that they can play with. Okay? And so then, so the thing that you want to understand, again, as I said earlier, is that if you have 50 training examples that are labeled, as well as 1,000 unlabeled examples, you really are richer than your friend who only has 50 training examples that are labeled. Previously, you would think if 50 training examples labeled both of us are equal. Okay? But having examples which can deserve a label is in itself telling you about the domain. Do you understand what I'm saying? Not every random generation. So when I give you real documents, that basically means that I'm telling you these documents actually exist. They're either positive or they're negative. They're not just randomly generated. These are existing documents. So I gave you more information about the structure of the domain. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's why your friend has, so this guy actually has more data, more information, which is these unlabeled examples, which once they exploit using the idea that I mentioned, they are now able to get higher accuracy at every point. Eventually, they'll all reach the same accuracy. Okay? But in the middle, you know, you basically this unlabeled example is a way you can improve your accuracy. And in the web, on the web, this is just a great, great idea, because the hardest thing to do is to get people to rate items. That's why you had that previous slide in the beginning where I said, how do I get people to rate items without bugging them? And here I am saying, as long as I just know the universe of items, do you understand what I'm saying? As long as I know the universe of items and their feature descriptions, okay? Even if the label of those items with respect to the user is not known, that is extra knowledge I can use to bootstrap myself. And a very related idea, so this is one idea. So I said in the previous case, actually I was using two different learning ideas. One is content-based, one is collaborative. Both were trying to tell. So here is an interesting situation. Suppose content-based predictor told you that you should like this, you know, with rating 4. Collaborative predictor, if they're both correct, both content-based and collaborative filtering should be giving the same rating for that item. So if in some cases it turns out that a particular example can be classified in two different ways, but its class description should be the same irrespective of how you came to it. Okay? As a classic example that you can think of in a minute is consider that. Consider I'm trying to classify web pages as course pages, or you know, with any random, you know, text classification idea. Okay? Now, X1 is the bag of all the words on the page. X2 is bag of all the words from all the anchors pointing to that page. In general, these are two orthogonal ways in which you get to classify the page. In the ideal case, both of them should be able to correctly classify the page. Right? But in the non-ideal case, they can help each other. Just like content-based and collaborative filtering helped each other, they can help each other. And that is the idea of co-training. It's a very deep idea. It's a nice, you know, technique that works very well. And all you are saying is, if you happen to have a classification scenario where the example is described in terms of a set of features X1 and another set of features X2, such that X1 and X2 are really coming from two orthogonal dimensions. Okay, so for example, some particular thing which has sound-based features and visual features, those are orthogonal. In this case, anchor text-based features, which is telling you what other people think about this page, and the words on the page, which the author, what the author thinks about this page. Ideally, they should both give the correct rating. So in this particular case, if in fact there is a label for X, which is F of X, okay, then in the ideal case, there should be F1 and F2 that are learnable, such that F of X1 equal to F of X2, F1 of X1 equal to F2 of X2 equal to F of X. Okay? In such a case, then what you can do is that in particular what happens is, since both of these are causing the label, given the label, this would be independent of this. Okay? And what that means is when one of these learners is still wrong, the errors that this learner makes would be essentially noise with respect to this learner. Because they are given the class label, one is independent of the other. Okay? So what co-training winds up doing is it basically starts with the data, computes a learner based just on the X1s, applies that X1 to then give everybody a label, even the ones which didn't have labels yet, the unlabeled data, labels, and then apply the F2. Okay? And it turns out that this kind of co-training is actually, again, yet another way, essentially, of exploiting unlabeled examples. Okay? And in fact, in a way, this is closer to the idea of content-based and collaborative filterings being combined, because you essentially had two different learning techniques there. Okay? I want to mostly mention it here. I'm not going to go into the details. But essentially, it turns out that unlabeled examples are useful. And that's because you didn't make up those examples. The teacher made the examples. They didn't give the label to them, but they made the examples. So they had an answer. You don't know what the answer is. Okay? The worst thing that can happen to you if you're in grade school is you've done all the problems and I will make up some new problems. You can easily make up open problems, because you don't know enough about how to make problems. Whereas if I make problems, and if I, to the extent I am a teacher, during the exam, you know that even though they're all unlabeled, they actually have answers, because I spend time. Having said that, I also know that the greatest exams are those where during the middle of the exam, the teacher comes and says, oh, by the way, the first question, that doesn't have any answer. Don't do it. Okay, it happened to me once in my qualifier exam in computer science when I was a grad student. After we spent like half the exam working on the first question, the teacher came and said, yeah, by the way, I just found out that the first question doesn't have any answer, so don't worry about it, do the other. So if you did the first one for the first half, you're sunk. Okay? But the point is that you assume that the examples that are made by teacher, that actually exist in the real world, are telling you something about the real world, even if they're missing the label. Okay? So we'll stop here. This completes our discussion of recommender systems. It also completes our discussion of classifier systems, and it also talks, and in the end we talked about how we could use unlabeled examples to improve classifier systems, which is something that's very useful in web-based learning scenarios. Okay? Next class onwards, we'll start talking about structured data and how to use databases in the context of web, what to make of them. Okay? And so And also, if there is not enough structure, how can you extract the structure so that you can do structured data analysis in the web? So that's what we'll do starting next class. I have your exams here, so you know you can come and pick them up.